pants.
In pants.
So, for those of you who are downstairs in the Minion, you heard me inform everyone that we have a tremendous zechus this morning to welcome Rabbi Aryeh Leibowitz to our yeshiva. Rabbi Aryeh Leibowitz and I just reminisced that we probably know each other for 30-something years back from camp, probably. But not exactly, can't really exactly remember. Rabbi Aryeh Leibowitz, it's not an exaggeration to say that he is one of the greatest Talmidei Chachamim in America. He is perhaps the most prolific teacher of Torah on the internet, YU Torah. How many people learn Daf Yomi? The 10-minute halacha series. How many times have I used the 10-minute halacha series to create a shiur? Too many to count. I've used them so many times. Or to prepare for Pesach, 10 biggest issues in a Pesach hotel. I remember that one well. Rabbi Leibowitz fields, as you'll learn, shilos from, I don't know, very wide audience. And I think we are privileged. I know we are privileged to learn from Rabbi Leibowitz this morning. Just a personal thank you for being here with us. Please give your undivided attention to Rabbi Leibowitz.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Rabbi Nicky. It is always so much fun to come to Hank. I miss teaching in high school, and it's always the Hank crew is always a lot of fun. You guys always have a lot of personality.
Yeah,
I always enjoy it.
Hank makes it happen.
And Hank makes it happen. That's right.
Yes.
I'm going to ask you to, would you be my lovely assistant and pass these around? Okay, thank you. What I'd like you to do for a few minutes. First of all, Mrs. Zucker, what time should we finish? What's the...
I mean, I wouldn't mind if you go to 10:30, then I give them a break.
Okay,
a little bit.
Great.
If you, the question answers, we'll see how it goes.
All right, great. Okay, what I'd like you to do is what you have in front of you, or you're about to have in front of you, is last night I started cutting and pasting a list of questions that people had either texted me, emailed me. Oh, these are all over the past year. I know you guys weren't here last year when I spoke, but I don't like repeating the same things from year to year. So these are questions that all came up in the last year. Maybe I'll ask, like, if this side of the room could start reading from number one, and this side of the room could start reading from the end, from number, 16? And then hopefully you'll meet in the middle, and you'll tell me which one of these are interesting to you, and we'll go through a bunch of them, you know, whatever you find interesting. And I'm just going to keep talking until while you're reading, so that I'll give you a little bit of time to read. Read, yeah, go ahead. So one of the fun things about being a rabbi is that you never know what kind of question somebody's going to ask you, and sometimes it's like real life is very, very exciting. It's much more exciting than like whatever you could learn. In learning from a sefer is also very exciting, but like in terms of how things play out and how things actually happen in real time, so it's a lot more dynamic. You get to see how the Torah that Hashem gave us really guides us in every kind of situation. And especially in the year 2023, where a lot of weird stuff happens, and there are a lot of, I mean, let's be honest, a lot of weird people in the world that have funny things going on in their lives. So, in general, whenever I go speak places, you know, if I were to tell you what I want to talk about, you might be interested in it or you might not be interested in it. But if you tell me what you want to talk about and I give you 16 choices, then it's your fault if you don't like it, because, you know, it was your choice, you know. So keep on reading. Let me know if you see anything that catches your attention and that you find interesting. Yeah? Number 14. Okay, so we have a request already for number 14. Let me see what number 14 is. Oh, that taka is a good one.
Are you allowed to sell them?
Oh, that's a good question. Okay, so maybe we'll get to it. So maybe we'll get to it. Let's see if there are any other requests first. And we'll, yeah?
One.
Oh, you didn't follow the instructions, unless you're a very fast reader, right? You're supposed to read from the end. Number one. Okay, so that's good. All right, so we have a request.
Skimming around.
Okay, that's fair. All right. No, none of the young women here have any interests. Yes. Number six. Yeah, that's a good one. That's an excellent one. Okay. Number three.
Number two.
Okay. So now we have a lot. All right. So we have a.
flip it over.
We have a lot of choices. Well, let's see what it's asking exactly. Oh, that's an excellent question. Did Rashi's daughters put on tefillin? Okay, so let's see. I don't think there's any record of Rashi's daughters putting on tefillin, but it is a very common misconception that Rashi's daughters, they didn't, but it's a very common misconception.
Rashi's daughters did not.
No way, no way.
Why
is that a misconception? Because Rashi's daughters were ahead of their time in that they were educated, they knew how to read and write, which for women at that time, women didn't get an education at that time. So people just like, you know, expand that to like, yeah, they put on tefillin and they whatever, you know, but they didn't actually, right? Yeah, you know, whatever. That's the way things sometimes get spread. But okay, so should we start with number 14? Who's one that requests number 14?
David.
Okay, so David requests number 14. Okay, fantastic. So let me read it out loud, and then you'll tell me how to answer such a question, and I'll tell you how I answer such a question. Good morning. Question. This was a text. That's how people write, right? Good morning. Question. I have a side hustle in Philadelphia. This is a rabbi in Philadelphia sending me this this question. So he works full-time as a rabbi, but a lot of times rabbis like to have what they call a side hustle. You know what a side hustle is? Yeah, he's got to make a little money on the side because, you know, the rabbinate doesn't always pay, like, a ton of money. I know it may be shocking to you, but, like, you know, it's hard to get rich off being a rabbi or even sometimes make ends meet. So he says, I have a side hustle in Philadelphia selling mezuzahs and tefillin. Over the years, especially because of my relationships with non-Orthodox clergy, you're familiar with that term? You know what non-Orthodox clergy is, right? Like conservative rabbis, reform rabbis, right? I've gotten calls from non-Orthodox people, meaning the rabbis will send their people to this rabbi. Like the conservative rabbi will say, oh, you want a mezuzah, you know, because you want to put a mezuzah on your front door or something, call this Orthodox rabbi. He's the guy that could hook you up with a mezuzah. A mezuzah, is that a problem to give a non-Orthodox person a mezuzah? No, that's no problem at all, right? That's to the contrary. It's a great mitzvah. Good, let them get a mitzvah, right? You want them to have a kosher mezuzah. Usually they get scared off by the price, which I'm okay with, because I'm concerned selling to a family where it won't get used and it might get neglected. Meaning a lot of times, someone who's not Orthodox will call and say, I'd like a pair of tefillin. So like to get a pair of tefillin that's like, very questionably kosher, it's a few $100, but it's very likely that it's not kosher. This guy's not going to sell something so questionable. So what he's going to charge is going to be a couple of $1,000 probably. And the people were like, whoa, that's above my price range. I was never expecting it to cost that much. And he'll be like, okay, you know, take it or leave it. That's what I got. I only deal with high-end stuff, you know, and he's okay with that because he's nervous someone's going to buy a pair of tefillin and then throw it in the garbage or something when they decide they're not wearing tefillin anymore. I have a friend, actually, who was walking down the street in Manhattan once, and there was a garbage that had tipped over, and there was garbage all over the floor, and there was a pair of tefillin right there. And he's like, so he picked it up. He's like, what's my responsibility with this? What do I do with this? Now, obviously, the tefillin were puzzle, but still, even puzzle tefillin, you can't just leave like that. So he's nervous that such a thing would happen. So, okay, but here's where it gets interesting. I got a request yesterday from a conservative family that they're conservative, meaning conservative Judaism, not like Republicans, you know what I'm saying, right? Like a conservative family, that they're interested in buying tefillin for their daughter. I know the family personally. The mom's father was a Shomer Shabbos conservative rabbi. That used to be a thing. That used to be a very common thing, that there were Orthodox people that worked as conservative rabbis. That's where they were able to get jobs, and they sometimes were able to have influence on families that way, whether it's the right thing or the wrong thing, we don't have to get into right now. But the grandfather was a Shomer Shabbos conservative rabbi. They've been to our home, it should say, that's a typo, to our home for meals on Shabbos, and I could see them switching to Orthodoxy and to my shul down the road, meaning he's identified this family as a family that really has potential, right? Meaning this is a family of people who are interested, they're going to grow, they may want to learn more. But so let me just finish the question. Can I sell to them? I think she'll take care of the tefillin, and if she's going to be trying to do the mitzvah, she may as well do it with kosher tefillin. Do you have thoughts on this? Have you seen anyone give a psak on it? Right, so that is the question. By the way, when someone concludes with, have you seen anyone give a psak on it, a lot of times the reason, why are they reaching out to me? I'm just like, a small rabbi in North Woodmere, you know, in some little corner of Long Island, right? Why are they reaching out to me? Because I happen to teach in a place called the Yeshiva University. Yeshiva University is a place that has some of the greatest Torah minds in the world. So they know that I have WhatsApp. The great poskim, Rav Schechter, Rav Willig, you know, they're not answering WhatsApp questions. So I have access to the big ones, right? To the big people. So a lot of times people will send me the question, not because I have the answers, but because I have access to the people that have the answers. So a lot of times that's like implicit in the question, where they'll try to like, they want to be nice about it. They don't want to say like, you know, I don't really care what you think, you know, just like get me like someone who matters, get me their opinion. So they want to be nice about it, but like that's how you read between the lines of a question. Like, have you seen any of our rebbeim? Have you seen anyone that like has what to say about this? Anyway, all right, so here's the question. So yeah, so what to say? All right, so how would you attack this? I mean, what's the issue? What would be the problem? Selling a Peretz Villain, what's the big deal? What would be the problem with selling a Peretz Villain?
A girl.
It's a girl, right, okay, good. And so what?
Girls don't have the obligation.
Ah, girls don't have the obligation to put on Peretz Villain. Is it an avera for a girl to put on Tefillin?
That's the question.
Ah, so that's the question. Meaning, if it's a problem, what's that? If she's going to say the bracha, it might be, if she's going to say the bracha and she has no obligation, it might be a bracha levatala. Right?
Wearing it publicly in front of other people.
And what's the problem with wearing it publicly in front of other people?
Okay,
Maris. Ayin, okay, we'll have to see. Yeah, something else?
When you put on a girl, you're like, first of all, girls don't have to wear it because they're already higher than like the level that men are on. Kind of
you hear that, ladies?
Kind of be disrespecting the level that they're on by putting on the
single,
saying that they're low.
Okay, interesting. Is that why you like that? But is that true? Meaning, is that why girls don't wear tefillin because they're on a higher level than men are on? I mean, maybe they are, but I don't know if that's why they don't wear tefillin. Just not obligated. One second. Let me get names as they do. What's your name?
Eden.
What? Yusupov. Okay. Nice to meet you. Tehila? Rabana Poor? Okay, that's a Persian name?
Yeah.
Okay, fantastic. And? Fantastic. That's not a Persian name. Okay. all right. So the question is, like, what's the big deal? What do you have to lose if you sell them tefillin? Now, what's the downside of saying no? Is there any downside to saying no?
Yeah.
It's too expensive to buy a new
pair.
You can
lose them.
So a bunch of you are saying, maybe let's do this by a raise of hands and calling out. But a bunch of you just said that you're going to lose this family. Meaning, here's a family that you could really help and that you might have a future. You're going to turn them away and you're going to say, sorry, I'm not into this conservative stuff of girls wearing tefillin. And then they're going to be like, you know what? Then maybe this rabbi is not for us and maybe his brand of Judaism isn't for us. And then maybe you're going to lose them in the long term. So sometimes you have to lose a battle to win the war, right? Meaning, you know, sometimes... Or what is it?
It's
lose the sprint to win the marathon? Oh, whatever, right? Yeah. Sometimes you got to keep the long game in in mind. Yeah. Name, sorry.
I'm
Chalva.
Chalva?
Chava. So Chava has a very interesting point. Why is it your business to ask them what they're going to do with it? Right? Meaning you're providing a service, you're running a business, you're selling something.
Like you're telling them.
The problem is that when you're selling most things, like if I'm selling a car, okay, so buy the car and use it or don't use it. I don't care if you take the car and you decide that what you want to do with my car is that you are going to bring it to a monster truck rally. Anyone ever been to a monster truck rally? I've actually been to one. There was one in Nassau Coliseum, and we were bored in Chol HaMoed. And I'm like, kids, we're going to a monster truck rally. They're like, what? I'm like, I don't care. We're going. So we just watched trucks drive over cars all day. It's an interesting crowd that goes to a monster truck rally. Like, you know, I think I was the only guy without a gun. But but let's say if the guy wants to buy my car, and it may make me sad that he wants to use it to get run over by a truck with giant tires. But it's not really my business. But maybe tefillin is my business a little bit. Because I have to protect things that have kedusha, things that have holiness. I have to make sure that they don't get mistreated. What do you mean, change his view?
If he doesn't care,
Everyone's going to be like, oh, but like...
Very good. A lot of times when rabbis do things, people say, oh, the rabbi must approve.
Right.
So people will say that, meaning this is not just a guy running a business, it's his side hustle. Yeah. So it could be that people will think that he approves. Let's try to wrap it up to get to the next question. Just one more comment, yeah.
How could he say that the kind of, he could see them switching to orthodoxy if the daughter's putting on
because
they seem a little bit lost, but
it's important to realize that a lot of times when people are just totally religiously disinterested, that's a lot worse than when someone is searching and they're grasping and they're trying to find their way, because if they're trying to find their way and they have the right relationships, so then you can guide them in that direction. There's a woman in my shul who is a convert. She converted 3 times. First time she converted was a conservative conversion. Second time she converted was like a low-level Orthodox conversion. And third time she converted was a high-level Orthodox conversion. So she remembers. She leaned from the Torah, and she put on tefillin, and she did all this stuff. She was on a journey. Ultimately, the journey led her to become a very, very religious, wonderful, you know, from person who does great things. You should actually have her speak here. She's amazing. She has an amazing story. So maybe next year, senior seminar or something. Like, I got to put that on the list. People are on a journey. So what's the answer to this question? So let's think about it like this. Why is it that women don't wear tefillin? Meaning, I assume none of you wear tefillin? Hopefully all of you wear tefillin. Right? It's a time-bound mitzvah. So women are exempt from tefillin because it is a time-bound positive mitzvah. But guess what else is a time-bound positive mitzvah?
Sukkah.
Excellent. Lulav is a time-bound positive mitzvah. Shofar is a time-bound positive mitzvah. What?
Svardim do sit in
sukkahs. Svardim women. Oh, but not a bracha. Okay, but the difference between Svardim and Ashkenazim is that Svardim and Ashkenazim agree that women should volunteer time-bound positive mitzvahs if to the best of their ability. There's Ashkenazim would say a bracha on it. Svardi women would not say a bracha on it. But all agree that even a Svardi woman should sit in sukkah if she can, and even take lulav. You take lulav?
Yeah.
Once? Okay. But really, you should, right? It's a wonderful thing to do. But why is it like a negative to put on tefillin? Won't be so bad. So let's turn to the men for a second. What's the mitzvah of tefillin? How often are you supposed to put on tefillin?
Every day.
Is that the mitzvah once a day, every day?
No, all day.
Oh, so really the mitzvah is all day. So why don't we do it all day? Meaning, why are none of us wearing tefillin now? We don't do it nowadays. Why not? Meaning, we do mitzvahs. Oh, very good. The halacha is that tefillin require certain clean thoughts, and not just clean thoughts, a clean body. That if a person, you know, you'll excuse me, but if a person, you know, passes gas and has other bodily functions while they're wearing tefillin, that's a terrible, terrible thing to do while you're wearing tefillin. So we're so nervous that you can have bad thoughts and bad bodily functions while you're wearing tefillin that we minimize it as much as possible. Now, men don't have the option of just saying, okay, so I'm not going to wear tefillin. We don't have that option. Why don't we have that option? Because we have a mitzvah, we have a requirement. So we minimize it. How do we minimize it? We just put it on for davening, for chakras. And maybe there's some people that put on for mincha also, very rare, but we just put on for the most part, for chakras. We just put on for chakras. So women don't need to take that risk. There's no imperative for a woman to take that risk of not, meaning it's so risky that we minimize our mitzvah to the bare minimum. What's the bare minimum a woman could do with tefillin? Is not do it at all. So that's why women don't do it at all. So that's why the Ramah writes in Shulchan Aruch, it's true, it's Ramah, so it's Ashkenazi Pesach, but the Ramah writes in Shulchan Aruch that we should, that women should absolutely not wear tefillin. That's the reason. Is it an Aveira if a woman wears tefillin? Is it like eating pork? Is it like, no, it's not really an Aveira. Are you really causing this girl to do an Aveira by giving her tefillin? I mean, as long as you're sure that she's, or you're confident that she's going to treat it well, and she's going to treat it with respect, and you're going to be there for this family along the way, I'm not sure that it's such a bad idea to sell them the tefillin. I would think that it would be okay to sell them the tefillin. Not really, because this is a conservative family doing conservative things. Now, if she wanted to put on tefillin in an Orthodox shul or an Orthodox school, that would be a different story, right? Then the rabbi should for sure say that, look, this is not Orthodox Jewish practice, and while I respect and respect or don't respect, but whatever, while I understand that you come from a different kind of home, if you sign up to be part of an Orthodox shul, a part of an Orthodox school, you got to do Orthodox Jewish practice, right? Meaning, a lot of times you have kids in a high school, let's say, that haven't fully bought in to Orthodox Jewish life, but the high school has a right to say, look, Orthodox Judaism believes you got to daven. So you can't force someone to daven, but you got to sit there and you got to be respectful. Right, meaning you sign up for Orthodox school. That's what you got to do.
So didn't you say, or rabbi said you should not do it? Isn't that an usur
for? Right. So we say that she shouldn't because it's not worth the risk. But it's not quite the same as violating an act of issue. It's just too risky for us to recommend it. So we don't recommend it because it's too risky. It's not a great idea. And certainly we would if she was asking should I or shouldn't I, the answer is shouldn't. But that doesn't make it lifnei iver, that you're causing them to do an avera. To the contrary, you might be helping them do a mitzvah. She might get credit for a mitzvah every time she puts on tefillin, the same way every time she sits in sukkah, she might get credit for a mitzvah. So you're actually helping her do a mitzvah. Okay, let's keep it moving. Let's move on to the next. Are we? What? Number eight? Did you have a different request? What? Which number did you want?
Number 11.
Okay, so let's see, 8 or 11. Eight is tefillin also?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, maybe let's move on from although, I'm just curious. I'm just curious about eight for a second. We're not going to answer eight. But take a look at eight. Can you read eight for a second? How many of you know someone who's gotten this? Yeah, it's like become really, really popular to get. So it's an interesting question. Most people that get it do not ask the question. But I where I come from, you know, in the five towns, I would bet hundreds of people have gotten this, like, hair transplants. It's become, like, very popular because it's like this whole VIP service. You pay $3,500, you fly business class to Turkey, they have a concierge, like, that gets you glatt kosher food and whatever. The whole thing sounds awesome except for the hair transplant. I would do the whole rest of it, just, you know, except for the hair transplant. I'm perfectly fine being bald, you know, you get old, that's fine. I'm okay with that, you know, but, like, you know, so, what was that?
You still know where your hairline is.
I still know where my hairline is.
I'm saying, like, if you need to get that haircut, you're still going to know where your hairline is.
Okay. Oh, no, because no, it's not because of that. It's because right after the surgery, it's very delicate. So if you put, you're not allowed to put anything down on the, because it will ruin the...
Put on a Friday afternoon.
Oh, so, okay, well, we can talk about that. There were suggestions on Chol HaMoed, okay, but, you know, so there, yeah, there are all sorts of suggestions. Okay, but one second, what was the one that someone else said? Not eight?
11,
okay. Okay, this is a funny one. Hi, Rabbi Leibowitz. I was told I can email you a question. I hope it's okay with you. Okay with me. This is like how I make my living. Like, I go around speaking about this stuff. I apologize if it's long. It is, right? It's the longest one on the page. But, okay. My daughter received a pair of diamond earrings from my parents for her college graduation 2 weeks ago. A week later, she went to Israel to be an advisor on a birthright trip. You guys familiar with birthright?
Yeah,
okay. While she was gone, on Shabbos afternoon, I went to her room to see if she left the earrings at home, since I was nervous she'd be hiking and swimming with them and may lose them. That the woman has just proven what? That she is a Jewish mother, right? She is a certified Jewish mother, that she's getting nervous in her head on Shabbos afternoon. Who knows, maybe my daughter has her diamond earrings in some, you know, river in Israel somewhere. Okay, so she's in her room. I found her jewelry sitting on her desk next to a black velvet box with only one diamond earring in it, along with a necklace. I panicked that there was only one there, and had my mother come up and help me search her. And I had my mother come up and help me search her carpet. We couldn't find it, and I was so upset. And as I usually do, I said the pasuk of Rav Meir Balanes. Okay, so she almost lost me here. What was that? What's that? What's that? What does she do? I get what it means to look for an earring on the carpet. What does it mean to say the pasuk of Rameir Balanes? What's she referring to?
She wants to get it back.
Ah, so there's this thing. There's this idea that when you lose something, you say this thing about Rameir Balanes, and then you magically find it. So she said the buzzer Rameir Balanes. It's not a pasuk, but whatever. But this time, oh, and apparently you don't just say it. I didn't know this. You also promised to give tzedakah. So this time I promised an unusually high amount for tzedakah. Since I was upset that she lost the gift my parents had just bought her, I promised $3,600. What do these earrings cost? I don't know. How expensive are earrings? $3,600. Get new earrings. No? $3,600. That's a lot. I then stayed up after Shabbos until 3 a.m. when it was the morning in Israel, and I called my daughter. That's a bit much. No? Again, Jewish mother. But also, like, the daughter has to sleep till 10 a.m. on Sunday. Like, let the daughter wake up at 8. You don't have to stay up till 3. Stay up till 1. I don't know. She couldn't imagine why I was up. I told her I was stressing that she lost the diamond earring and told her how I went to look and only found one. She started laughing and said, "That's not her real earring. That's an old earring she found somewhere in the house that isn't real. Her new diamond earrings were somewhere else, safe and sound." So under normal circumstances, I would be thrilled to give the $3,600 and know that everything worked out. But I'm going through a divorce, and if I use my husband's foundation card, this is when I learned what a foundation card is. Anyone know what a foundation card is? It's like if people who are wealthy that have charity funds and accounts and whatever, like separate things for their charity. So they have a separate card for that. So that's their foundation card. So and if I use this card without asking, he's going to be upset with me. And I'm in no position to ask him. I do have the money saved on my own that I could use, but I don't know what I may need that money for one day, meaning she might soon be a single mom, and she doesn't know what the divorce settlement's going to be and how much money she's going to need. So to just drop $3,600, not so simple for her. I'm wondering if the earrings are considered to have been lost, if my daughter knew where they were the entire time, and I just didn't. Am I required to stick to my nether of giving the $3,600? And it's okay if I do have to. I wouldn't want to chance it that I owe it and I don't pay it. I'll make it work and figure out a way to give the tzedakah. Thank you so much in advance for taking the time to read this. If you have any questions, please feel free to email me back or to call me. Wow. Okay, so what do you guys think? By a show of hands, how many of you think she has to pay the $3,600?
I think she should.
How many of you guys think she doesn't have to pay the $3,600? How many of you don't know? How many of you don't even know what the question is? All right, okay, good. All right. You know what the question is, Chava. You were listening. Yeah, okay.
Why would she promise her?
Yeah, like, regardless of if the earrings were lost or not, she still would have had to do that.
She doesn't have the money.
She knew she didn't
have the money.
Meaning, why would she promise money that she doesn't have easy access to? So sometimes when a person wants, I understand, but sometimes when a person wants like an extraordinary zuchus, or they want something that's really going to help them, they go beyond like their means. They take that extra step. If I want God to go beyond, you know, the normal way of doing things with me, so I go a little bit beyond with Him, and I'll spend more. So that's probably what her thinking was. Whether it was smart or not, the bottom line is she did it. So the question is she obligated to pay it? So again, who thinks she is obligated to pay it? All right, now back it up. Why is she obligated to pay it?
She did a neder.
What's that? She promised it. When you take a neder for tzedakah, when you promise money for tzedakah, you have to give it. You're not allowed to make a neder and then not live up to it. You got to live up to it.
I'm probably wrong, but the fact that it was like lost to her, even though it wasn't really lost, and she said the pasuk to try to find it and promised a certain amount of money to Hashem, means that she has to give it.
Oh, excellent point. Meaning
it was lost to her.
Right. So what the real crux of the question is were these earrings ever lost? Meaning, because if we say that the fact that they were lost to her means that they were lost, then she's got obligated to pay. What's the counter argument? That they were never really lost. She only promised because she thought they were lost. She never would have promised had she realized that they weren't lost. What's that called? When you make a commitment because of a mistaken premise. Anyone ever hear of that? Right, there's something called a neder b'ta'us, or a mekach ta'us, or a kiddush ta'us. It comes up in different contexts. When the whole thing was based on, you were working with false information. Had she had the information, had she known that these weren't really lost, she never would have taken that neder, and therefore maybe the neder's not binding. Is that what you wanted to say? What's your name? Yosef. So Yosef argues they were never really lost. Had she known they were never really lost, she never would have taken the neder. Can you argue against that? What would be the counter argument against that? Very good. Meaning, if she said when they are found, that's the difference. So when I find it, meaning it's about me losing. What's your name?
Avi.
Baruch. Nice to meet you. So, I asked her what she said, actually, but I don't think I asked her to that detail. I asked her if she actually said anything, or if it was just a thought in her mind, because that could make a difference. If you just think things, a lot of times people have thoughts in their mind and they think that that's the same as making a verbal commitment. It's not. Not every thought is a statement. Not every thought is a commitment. I once had a case, actually. It was a very sad case. I had a student who, when he was in middle school, was bullied, like, terribly by a kid on his bus or something. And this kid, like, made his life miserable. And he went home every night, like, crying. And he was thinking, I wish this kid would die, right? That's what, like, he really thought terrible things. And the kid died, like, in some tragic accident or something. So the kid that was bullied was carrying this with him, that, like, meaning now he's dealing with the fact that he thinks every time he has a thought that it's going to happen. I mean, that's like a tefillah, and every tefillah you have is, you know, that he has this koach tefillah, this power of davening for things. And he's afraid of thinking about things or anything negative. And when you try very hard not to think about negative things, you think about it, right? It's like, don't think about a pink elephant, right? Meaning, like, you know, so, like, he's gonna be thinking about. So his therapist reached out to me. Therapist is trying to do something called exposure therapy.
Yes.
Really,
oh,
exposure,
my God.
Right?
I learned about this.
Oh, okay. So, like, I have a niece, for example, that's terrified of cats. So they, like, slowly expose her to cats. They don't, like, chuck her in a room with 50 cats and say, okay, you're, you know, they very slowly, here's a picture of a cat, you know, look at it for a little bit, and then, you know, slowly, slowly. So how do you do exposure therapy on a kid like this? What do you do? What do you do for
exposure?
What?
It's not funny. No, it's the AP psych that we studied before.
Oh, okay. How do you do, so I'm helping you study for an AP? All right, good. So, oh, you already took it? Okay. How do you do exposure therapy on something like that? What do you do?
Make them think thoughts.
Right, you have them think slightly negative thoughts, and you see that nothing happens. So the therapist actually wanted him to start davening for bad things. I'm like, I don't think that's a good idea. I don't think he's supposed to do that, you know? But you know, realize that not every thought is a tefillah. Why did I say this? Oh, because the woman actually verbalized it. She actually said it. She actually said, I am committing $3,600 to tzedakah based on the Rav Meir Bal Nasi. But let's back up another step. Where does the Rav Meir Bal Nes thing come from? Is that really a thing?
No.
Is that really?
No,
so it's based on, there is a Gemara. there is a Gemara that tells us that someone once said, Elokah deMeir aneini, that the God of Rabbi Meir should answer me, and they were answered right away. So that was taken to mean that we could daven for lost objects. I'm not sure how it got to lost objects, but we could daven to find lost objects in the zechus of Rabbi Meir Bal Nes. The story in the Gemara is actually a pretty crazy story. The story was that Bruria, anyone know who Bruria was? So Bruria, other than the name of a school in New Jersey, Bruria was the wife of Reb Meir. She was a very intelligent and chashuva woman, and she was the daughter of Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion. And apparently, her sister was being held captive, and in a brothel or something. Like, she was being used in very bad ways. So she said she needs to get her sister out. And she asked her mayor to go help out her sister, see what he could do. So Rameir said, well, I have to see, did she turn bad or not? Meaning, like, if she's really behaving herself. So he went and he sent someone with money to try to proposition her. And she said, no, it's not a good time for me. I'm not feeling well, whatever, this and that. There are so many other girls here prettier than me. And he said, okay, obviously she's trying to avoid doing any averos, and that's why she's making all these excuses. So he then started negotiating with the warden, with the jail warden, to let her out. And he gave him a bag full of money, and he told the guy, look, if any government officials start questioning where she went, here, take this money. You could bribe them, and you could still, save some money for yourself. And the warden gave her over. And at the end, the government found out about it, and the warden was being taken for judgment, you know, on the gallows. He was going to be hanged. So the warden at the time, when he was about to be hanged, said, Elaka de Meir Aneni, the God of Meir should answer me, because that's what he was instructed by Rav Meir to do. And they took him down. They said, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, there was this whole thing with Rav Meir, and he told me, and they put Rav Meir's picture on the gates of Rome, and they said that anyone who sees someone looking like this, they should bring him to Rome. And one day, some Romans saw Rav Meir, and they ran after him, so he ran away from them, and whatever it was. And again, he got to say, Elaka de Meir Aneni, and he was answered. So apparently there's some value. It's crazy stories in the Gemara, but apparently there's some value in saying the God of Meir should answer me. So that's what this woman was trying to take advantage of. So is it a neder? Is it really lost? I mean, was the stuff really lost? So I asked a few different rabbis what they thought about this. Let's say it is a neder. Let's say she actually took a neder. Is there any way to get rid of that?
Yes.
Oh, so you can do Ataras Nedarim. So generally speaking, you could do Ataras Nedarim. Generally speaking, you're not supposed to do Ataras Nedarim for a Nidre Mitzvah. For a Neder to do a Mitzvah, you're not really supposed to do Ataras Nedarim. So Rabbi Sabalovsky thought, he was one of the great poskim in NYU, one of the great halachic minds, why you thought that she could do Ataras Nedarim. Rabbi Schechter, who is the greatest poskim in America today, Rav Herschel Schechter, was of the opinion that the whole neder was betaus, it was never really lost, because the daughter knew where it was the whole time, and she just doesn't have to give the money. Okay, next question. What else? We did so far. We only did two. Let's do some more. Next question. Yeah, which one?
Number two.
Question two. Oh yeah, this was a friend of mine. Yeah, so this is, all right, so we'll do this one quickly. A friend of mine was going to be Mesader Kiddushin at a wedding for the first time in his life over the summer, and for a cousin of his who's not so religious. So he kept calling me the whole summer, like asking for, like, you know, how do you do this? When do you say the bracha? What do you, like, all these questions that he had. And we were going through everything, and he was really trying to take notes, and he was going to do everything just the right way, and this and that. And he thought he anticipated everything. He thought he figured out everything that was going to go on at this wedding. And he had spoke to the bride and to the groom, and she went to the mikveh before. Like, he really took care of everything and explained to them only one ring, not a double ring ceremony. You know, the whole thing, how a Jewish wedding is supposed to be done. He really, really did a great job. And then, like, they asked him to walk down the aisle as the officiating rabbi. Okay, so sometimes that you do that. So he's like, okay, I'll walk down the aisle. And then after he walked down the aisle, the person to walk after him wasn't a person. It was a dog with a bow tie. That was walking down the aisle after him, and he's like, okay, that's weird, but all right. And then they do the whole ceremony. The dog sat there nicely, didn't poop on the floor or anything, so that was good, right? And then after the chuppah, ooh, this is something Sephardim don't do, but Ashkenazim do. After the chuppah, where does an Ashkenazi couple go that a Sephardi couple does not?
A yichud room,
right? Most Sephardim typically do yichud after the wedding, not right there after the chuppah. Some Sephardim will do a fake yichud, but not like a real yichud. I mean, they'll leave the door open or whatever. Rav Vadi Yosef's grandson said that his wife very much wanted yichud, and Rav Vadi Yosef said, we don't do that. You know, we're Sephardim, we don't do that. So he said, you can go into a room, but, you know, someone else will be in the room. So they showed up to the room, and Rav Vadya was sitting there learning. And, you know, so he was like, it wasn't exactly what she had envisioned, you know, like when she wanted the yichud. But so the couple got to the yichud room. So he says, okay, guys, go into the yichud room. So they go in, and they're like, wait, Sparky needs to come with us. We don't do anything without Sparky. So the question is, can you allow Sparky, right? That was the question? Yeah, can you allow Sparky into the Yichud room? Is there any problem with allowing Sparky into the Yichud room? Say again? No, no, a Yichud. Oh, so what does Yichud room mean? Yichud room means that you're all alone. And not to say you're all alone, you have two witnesses standing outside the locked door making sure that no one comes in, and we make sure that there's no other door that you can even get out of the room. We want to know that they were alone. According to many Rishonim, that's what makes them married. That they're not fully married until they've been alone for whatever it is, 8 minutes in a room together with no one bothering them. Right? That's the opinion of many Rishonim, that they need to be all alone in a room. So the question is having a dog with them, is that called being all alone in a room? But you're married now.
No, I'm saying you're not. But if there's a dog there, it doesn't change the status.
Ah, very good. Right? Meaning, there is an Isser called Yichud when you're not married. You're not allowed to be alone in a room with some random woman with a locked door for 8 minutes, right? You're definitely not allowed to do that. Are you allowed to do that if there's a dog in the room? You're still not allowed to do that, right? The dog doesn't save you from Yichud. Who saves you from Yichud? A person who, not just like, what if it was an infant?
Nope.
It does not save you. Why not? It has to be a person who, if they saw you doing something that wasn't appropriate, would either stop you or say something. Let's say the person just doesn't care. They're like, they themselves, you know, do stuff like that with random people and are not really, and they don't really care. It's like a college roommate in a secular college who just, like, you know, puts earplugs in and whatever and doesn't, you know, doesn't mind. So that doesn't save you from Yichud either. The only thing that saves you from Yichud is someone that would be bothered by it, that would say something about it, that would be, you know, or would report it to somebody. Even like a 7-year-old kid would save you from Yichud, because a 7-year-old would be like, I saw the weirdest thing, you know, like, and they would say what they saw to somebody, right? So the dog, while it's super weird, like it registers very high in the weird scale, it probably does not cause a problem of Yichud. Yeah. Question one. Number six, he said? One, six. Oh my gosh, you have so many. All right. 1, 6, 10. Which one should I do now? Oh, yeah, I knew you would ask for number 10. All right. Okay, so maybe we'll try to quickly do 1, 6, and 10, and then, right? And then that'll be it, all right? So let's do that, let's do it quickly. What was number one? What was it? Rabbi Leibowitz. This is a very terrifying shaila on my part. I regularly listen to your Daf Yomi Shir, and I'm contacting you to maintain anonymity in my own community. I am 69 years old and started becoming frum when I was a teenager. I have children and grandchildren who are Shomrei Mitzvot. I am also my shul's president. My Brit Milah was done nearly 70 years ago by a mohel. That's an autocorrect. It, you know, it's not a model. I don't think like a supermodel came and did his, right? By a mohel who was not Orthodox, using a clamp. A clamp was like this instrument that they would use to make Brit Milah idiot-proof, where you can't really mess it up if you apply the clamp in the right way. It also very often caused that they don't bleed, that the baby barely didn't bleed because it cut off all the circulation. Having just read an article by Rabbi Jachter, anyone know who Rabbi Jachter is? He's a Rebbe in TABC. You've heard of TABC?
Yeah.
So he's a very big Talmud Chacham in New Jersey. On bris-related issues, I fear that the clamps used then rendered me lacking a bris. What is my status and what do I need to do? So first of all, this is a brave man, right? Meaning the fact that he's asking this question means that he's willing to do, at the age of 69, 70 years old, he'd be willing to go through some sort of procedure that would fix whatever was done wrong. So this is a brave, brave man. Okay, so we'll keep this one short. Bottom line is, there's a lot of discussion about whether those clamps were kosher or not kosher. I spoke to a number of different posts. When I get a bris milah shaila, first person I always go to is my brother. I have a brother who, my only brother, is a big, big Talmud Chacham, really big Talmud Chacham, and he's also a moel. He's a Rosh Kollel in California, but he also works as a Mohel. And my brother said to me, I wouldn't be concerned about any bris done with the clamp. If it was done by a Jew and enough skin was removed, it's kosher, period. The poskim were against the clamp because they said it's bloodless. It's not really totally bloodless. There's always some blood that comes out. It is fine. I then asked Rabbi Yisrael Reisman. Anyone know who Rabbi Yisrael Reisman is? He's Rosh Yeshiva in the Yeshiva called Torah Vadas in Brooklyn. I'm very privileged to have a relationship with him. And he said to me that the Chazon Ish and Rav Moshe both held, Rav Moshe Feinstein both held, a single drop of blood is enough. There must have been some blood. And he says, we don't start up with Balei Tshuva, you know, and start questioning their bris, and it's just not a good idea. So this happened, it's good, it's fine, let them go on with life, it's fine. And that's pretty much what everyone said. So one second. Okay, so that was what did we say? 1, 6, and 10. Those are our final three.
1, 6, 10.
Okay, so we did one. Let's do six quick. A woman is a therapist who works in a place that deals with severe eating disorders. The patients eat their meals with a coach who encourages them and gets them to eat normally. From patients, meaning religious patients, can request and receive kosher food. But the default is that the food is not kosher. Can this woman work as a coach for a non-religious Jewish person who did not order kosher food? On the one hand, it's pikuach nefesh. What does that mean?
It's eating that someone's life.
Right, people die of eating disorders. It's a very, very tragic thing. So on the one hand, it's pikuach nefesh that she eats. But on the other hand, the patient would have access to kosher food if they wanted it. Obviously, the therapist is not authorized to order the kosher food for the patient. So it happens to be they had asked Rabbi Sabalovsky, and he said that it's okay. But the person asked me the question said, I don't think they really gave Rabbi Sabalovsky all the necessary details over here. So that is the Shaila. End of the day, what would you say? Can she coach her to eat the food? I mean, this is a person who would... Okay, so let's back up a second. What would the isser be? What would the problem be? Oh, well, I'm not eating non-kosher food, but I'm just a therapist. When I enable someone... what's that called? Lift the Eva, right? Very good. So when I... What was your name again? What was your name? Okay, thank you. So Livne Iver. So Livne Iver means that I am enabling someone to do an Avera. Now, if they could do the Avera without me, and I'm just helping them do the Avera, that's a much less severe issue. It's not as bad. But over here, this person will not eat unless I'm coaching them the whole time to eat. So they can't eat. They have this block, this mental block, that they will not eat, they cannot eat. These are severe, severe eating disorders. So they will not eat unless this person is coaching them to eat. So the concern is lifnei iver. What's the counter argument? So a bunch of you said? Pikuach nefesh. Now, what's going to happen if this therapist says, I'm sorry, I can't do this? Is the woman going to die?
Yes.
Is there even a slightly higher possibility that the woman will die? All you need is a slightly higher possibility that the woman will die, and then it's mutter. But the thing is, they could just hire a different therapist. Meaning what's more likely to happen is they'll fire her, and they'll say, look, if you're not willing to do your job, you're going to lose your job here. We'll find someone else who will do the job. Which is a higher likelihood. Unless this woman feels that she has a relationship with this patient, and because she has a relationship with this patient, she has a greater chance of success. Or if she feels that she's a uniquely skilled therapist, she has to really be, you know, confident that she has a unique skill set that other therapists don't have. That it's not just like, okay, next man up, and the next person will do just as good a job. So I don't know, how confident are we, you know, in the jobs that we do that, like, the next person up, you know, can't do as good a job. You know, I often think about that. Like, if people ask me, why did you move to Israel? I'm like, if I moved to Israel, would like my shulness, I mean, get another good rabbi, probably a better rabbi, you know, next man up, you know, like, so you often, she has to really ask herself honestly. What do you think?
So the question really is this person like, is her life dependent on the therapist?
is it even a slight chance that it's dependent on the therapist? Because for pikuach nefesh, you just need the slightest chance that it's that this could be life saving. So if the how do you measure that? It's very hard. So in the end of the day, I think that there's. The truth is, I asked a lot of different people, and while Rabbi Sobolevsky thought that she can continue working there, a lot of other rabbis told me they'll get another therapist to do the same job, and she should find somewhere else to work because she shouldn't be feeding someone.
Because it's like encouraging someone to, like, obviously you're not encouraging to eat non-kosher, but you're encouraging.
But you are, right? Right. You're giving them non-kosher.
But they also may be comfortable with that therapist. Like, if another therapist.
So, meaning if you feel that you have a relationship with a therapist, that's true. If the therapist has a unique relationship with them already, then for sure it's mutter, I would think. Okay, last one. Are we up for the last one of the day? Okay, number 10. So this one happened, What? Okay, well, we'll get there in a second. Which way are you trying to... I hope so. If they did it, l'shem shemayim, I hope Hashem will look at them. All right, guys, I need your attention. One last one. I got a call. This is me talking. I got a call from a young 20-year-old Kala. This is me writing the Shaila to some of my Rebbeim. She works as a makeup artist to make some money and hopefully support her chassan for a few years. Meaning he's still in college and he wants to learn a little bit, and she's going to be making some money in the meantime. And then he's going to go into a career in whatever, computer programming or something. Anyway, she was asked to do 4 faces for a chassana, for a wedding, and was told that it would be the mother of the kala, the kala's sister, and 2 bridesmaids. She came to the wedding, and after she did the first 3 faces, they said, Shoshana is next. You could imagine her surprise when Shoshana turned out to be a man in a dress. She is a young girl and was very flustered. Obviously, this is not something she would normally sign up for, and it was very cruel of the family to spring this on her with no warning. Afraid to take a stand, she did the makeup. Now she wants to know if she violated an isser of Lifnei Iver. We just mentioned Lifnei Iver. What would be the Lifnei Iver?
Yeah, promoting a sin.
What sin did she promote? She helped a man dress up as a woman, right, of Beged Isha, by making this man look like a woman. She said that the guy was very pleased with her work and took her number for future occasions, meaning the person that she did, Shoshana, said to her afterwards, I never felt so pretty in my life. You are a maestro. You're fantastic. I would like your number in case I ever need, it. So she wants to know, what should she do if she's called again?
Give her the wrong number. Give her a different number.
What would the first thing you'd have to address in this question be? Like, what's the first thing we need to know? So I don't know if that's the first thing, but one thing we definitely have to address, is it a violation of Shomer Nagiyah for this woman to be... So she said she used as many brushes as she possibly could, instead of putting things on with her hands. You still need to... Okay, I don't know, I shouldn't say I never put on makeup. I was on TV once and they put makeup on me, but whatever, that's a different story. But so I rarely put on makeup, but Shomer Nagiyah. But what else? What else is relevant over here?
The fact that he might beg Isha.
Meaning the Lifnei Iver and Beged Isha. But what do you need to know if it's a Lifnei Iver and Beged Isha? Is this a man or a woman? Like, does Halacha recognize this person? Does Halacha say? Does the Torah say there's no such thing as transgender? Or does the Torah say that, that when someone gets an operation, that they can change their gender? Without the operation, for sure not. Just a person saying, I identify as, right? That doesn't do anything. You are what you are, right? But in Allah. Okay, the argument that Hashem doesn't make mistakes. So it happens to be that on that issue... most, like an overwhelming majority of rabbis hold that you are what you are and it doesn't change no matter what kind of surgery you get. Meaning, let's imagine, I mean, this might be hard for this side of the room to imagine, but let's imagine you get into a terrible accident such that it's not so obvious that, you know, they wouldn't be able to identify your body as necessarily masculine, right? A terrible accident. And you didn't do it on purpose by getting surgery or anything like that. Just a terrible accident. Would you be a woman?
No.
Right? Obviously not, right? So most rabbis assume that even when you have a surgery, it doesn't change anything, right? It doesn't change your halachic status. And if you were born a man, whether you are now physiologically appear like one or not, you still need to put on tefillin, you still need, right? I mean, you still have all the normal men halachos. It could be that if you appear as a woman, you should not sit in the men's section of a shul. That's possible. It could be you shouldn't sit in the women's section of a shul either. That's also possible. So that's a tricky... That's a tricky thing. But almost all... There is one rabbi that seemed to say that it is something that can be changed with surgery. We generally reject that opinion, but there is such a major rabbi that seems to have said that at least for certain details that it could be that one can change their gender. We assume not that way. So we're going to assume that this Shoshana is a man. So now, is it Lifnei Iver to put on makeup?
Actually, no. They put on makeup for like movies.
Now, let's go back to something we said earlier. We said earlier that if the person can't do the Avera without you, and they need you, your help is the only way they can do the Avera, then that's Lifnei Iver. But if they can do the Avera without you, you're just greasing the wheels a little bit. You just make it easier. So Shoshana's ready wearing dress. If you don't put on makeup, one of Shoshana's other bridesmaids will do it for Shoshana, right? Meaning they'll take care of it. So it's not something that you're enabling. Although on the other hand, Shoshana said at the end, I never felt so pretty in my entire life. You know, no one's ever been able to work such magic on me to make me, you know, usually my beard makes me look ugly, you know, like no one's ever, you know, made it look so, has worked such magic on me to make me look so pretty, right? So, you know, you do have that argument. Generally speaking, you're not supposed to help someone do an Avera even if they could have done it without you. But if they're a person who doesn't care about the Avera and they could have done it without you, then it's not us, then it's Mutter. So I was able to tell her, look, what you did was not a problem, you know, but don't do it again. It was very wrong of these people to not tell her. Meaning there are countless non-Jewish or non-religious makeup artists that would be perfectly happy to do this job. Why did they have to call a frum girl, a young 20-year-old frum girl, to put her in this position? That was just mean. That is very not proper what they did. But they're not the ones. Obviously, they're not the ones that are asking the question. What about the Shomer Nagia? Is the Shomer Nagia a problem over there?
I don't think she's attractive.
Right. Meaning when it's very obvious that there's no physical attraction and that the touching is not at all, you know, is not at all affectionate or desirous or whatever. Right. So in such cases it's mutter. So Shomer Nagia would not have been a problem there. Although she spends a lot of time, you know, touching the face, so it could be that, you know, that could be a little bit much. All right. I was told to go till about 10:30. If anyone has questions, I'm happy to answer them. But I wish you, first of all, mazel tov in your upcoming graduation. And everyone should have
the rest of the year is like
just to go through
online or something.
They're all online now.